You're listening to IsraelScene.com, and I'm Steve, and my co-host, Yoram, is speaking with Yitzhak Chayutman somewhere in Jerusalem.
I'm sitting here in a little cabin-like place on the corner of Rehov Aza, and then on one side is Rehov Ha'ari, which is named in honor of the Ari, the great mystical teacher from Tzfat. And on the other side of the street is Rehov Metudela, named after Benjamin Metudela, the great traveler, Spanish traveler of several years ago who came by here maybe 1,000 years ago, 12th century. And I'm sitting here with a gentleman I've known for quite a while, Yitzhak Chayutman. And I'd like to start, Yitzhak, if we may, with Chayutman. Where does that name come from?
It took me time to discover that what my father thought about it is probably not what my grandfather meant when he converted the name Heisman to Chayutman. Chayes is a Yiddish for the same thing as in Hebrew Chayut, which in the Kabbalah and in the Hasidut is the whole principle of life, of divine intelligent flow that maintains everything. Man, on the other hand, is not just men, and it's not just a food to be scraped from the ground in the desert, but it's the acronym for Maim Nukbin, feminine waters, which means that when the community of Israel or anyone in it feels like a woman that is preparing herself for lovemaking, he raises the feminine waters in him. And this is the arousal of all of Knesset Israel to get union with God. So it's a very erotic concept for the religion, for bringing up from the ground up the influences to precipitate the divine flow from above. So to my great delight, I discovered that in the name I inherited anyway, there was a whole treasure and a whole formula for the divine influence in life.
You are the current representative of a family who's been here for quite a while, aren't you?
My grandfather, whom I'm named after him, was the founder of Tel Aviv, or one of a group of 5-6 people who founded it, but certainly the one with the original idea and the dream, the great vision of a city that will extend all the way to Haifa and will in fact comprise the New Jerusalem.
Speaking of people with ideas about cities, one of your areas of expertise is city planning. Can you tell us a little bit about your education and how you've arrived at where you are?
I think I had the luck of studying in very influential or very original places. I started studying architecture in England at the Architectural Association. It's a time that of the Beatles and all kinds of pop culture, and there was also pop architecture by a group called Archigram, of things like walking cities and linear cities from one side to another of England. And nowadays I discover that my designs for the third temple or for the future temple are very much in the spirit of those at times and the daring of this. But from there I passed to University of California in Berkeley, where I studied between 67 and 69. So, of course, these were the years to get a lot of the spirit of the 60s right at the hotspot of University of California, Berkeley. But there were also excellent teachers there. Just this week, I've discovered that the genius who was my reason to go over there, Professor Christopher Alexander, is now considered to be one of those people of the 20th century that will be remembered on the 25th century. A huge revolution in all the concept, what is architecture? He came with a methodology of patterns, pattern language for design, which he started with just for architecture, but it became now the great fashion or principle in computer programming, and it's now branching to sociology and to design of human organizations. The idea of there being patterns which are repeated in various ways. In fact, he speaks about the order of nature and the nature of order. And that was a way of doing architecture, which is, in a sense, the same which produces the architecture of our bodies and the architecture of every living system. And he was just one of the excellent people there. Another one was a methodology man called Horst Rittel that was doing very exciting work in methodology. But I studied more later, apart from my urban studies, a master in urban design from the Technion. I studied and received a doctorate in cybernetics, in cognitive systems, working with a man, a great genius called Gordon Pask in England, who also taught at the Architectural Association where I have been studying at first. And this was really for studying this methodology of pattern in consciousness, in cognitive systems. And again, amazing genius who received less recognition, I think, than Christopher Alexander, though he got all the degrees, two postdoctoral degrees and over 200 scientific publications and all the honors. But his work is so original and so unusual that it hasn't caught, but it obviously influenced me very deeply.
I know that you've been working a great deal and thinking a great deal about the temple, the past, the present, and the future. Is this how you came to these, or could you tell us how you came to your interest in the temple and some of your ideas about the temple?
It's hard to trace when it started. I know that in a certain stage of my life, which was after being in Brazil and after really having great changes wrought about by the participating in the carnival in Bahia, but where I was a consultant over big questions like where to put the next 100 million Brazilian citizens, inland or on the coast or big cities or small ones. And after this upheaval in the carnival, something happened, and I realized first that we don't know what the Earth wants. That the Earth should also be considered a client of urbanism and architecture. And it was such a novel idea at the time, I'm speaking about the 70s, that it got me completely off the tracks professionally. But when I was looking for explanations about all kinds of experiences I had with the land and thinking and working with the land in Brazil, I came upon a work, very curious work, by an English researcher, John Michel, who wrote a book called The City of Revelation, also The New View Over Atlantis, and later Dimensions of Paradise. He wrote about the heavenly Jerusalem, or the new Jerusalem, which, curiously enough, I never came upon these concepts all along my education in Israel, 12 years in the high school, one of the foremost high schools in Israel, the Hebrew Reali in Haifa. Never heard about the new Jerusalem. But when I read the book of this man, who started with experiences that people had with the land, with ley lines and with ancient monuments, and he built gradually, though surprisingly, to the concept of the New Jerusalem and what he described as a New Jerusalem diagram. And I got hooked by this book and by this concept of the New Jerusalem. So then I thought for a long time that I could thought about the New Jerusalem. I even wrote a booklet called Realizing the Heavenly Jerusalem, where I propose that the whole state of Israel, and earlier I was thinking about all the areas, all including the Golan and the Sinai, but anyway, about Israel becoming again the state of the 12 tribes, not just a Jewish state, not just an Arab state, not a country or a state for two nations, but the state for 12 brotherly tribes. This was part of the thinking about this New Jerusalem. But there was also much thinking about the city of Jerusalem and about doing something over the city. Now, it took many, many years how these ideas developed and how grew in me the commitment from the more abstract realizing heavenly Jerusalem to start regarding myself as in one way or another responsible for bringing the designs for the future temple. And this has been in continuous development, went through various stages. For instance, for 4 years I worked with a talented painter about painting four pictures of four perspectives of the quest for the heavenly Jerusalem temple. The first picture was from the west, from far away, where the land in the east, the orientation towards Jerusalem looked very fabulous and imaginary. But there was also some great things up in the sky, and a vision that was being built through all the pilgrims who are walking towards Jerusalem. And that was the first one. Then came another one called Realization, where we built, through the pictures, of course, a huge cube or box of steel trusses over the whole old city, with the columns based outside the old city. But this huge cube, like the new Kaaba that is coming, that has come to Jerusalem, contains within it another cube of transparent walls and clouds inside, which allow to do holographic projections of any shape and form that might be conceived. So this was the beginning of thinking very seriously about the Temple of Light above Jerusalem. As an aside, when people discuss a question of the third temple, in our tradition, there are two traditions about it. One is that the temple will be built by human work and construction teams, building from the grounds up. The other concept, which, for instance, by Rashi and a few others, that there will come what they call a temple of fire from heaven. That the temple will come ready and establish and come down. An image which is not too dissimilar to the image which appears in the book of Revelation, which concludes the Christian Bible, where the New Jerusalem descends down to earth and establishes itself there. And through making those various drawings, pictures, it grew in me how to design a temple which will be up in the skies over Jerusalem, yet will be human construction, but that eventually when everything is established, then with a flick of a switch, it comes on, already and shining, and so, you know, in a certain hour of the evening, it will be switched on. And with all the projectors and beams and holographic images. But of course, the important thing was to find not just what will make a spectacular light show, which is nice, but to make a meaningful one. one that has a spiritual significance of what's the korbanot, what's the offerings, temple offerings, used to be at that time. Because I believe that when we think about the third temple, I'm leaving the other two pictures aside and going to the main topic. When we think about the third temple, we should realize one thing, first of all, that it's not very likely, and there's no reason that it will be similar to the second temple. The Mishkan at the Gilgal was not like the Mishkan in the desert. The Mishkan in Nov or in Shiloh was not like the one in Gilgal. The Temple of Solomon was not like the Mishkan. The second Temple of Herod was not like the first. And now, 2,000 years later, and all the development of technology and science and the scale of operations on a global scale means that if at all to go through the bother, the danger, the adventure of a temple of Jerusalem, it can't be just a replica of the second temple. There's no point. And among the things which we may have to go is this idea that everybody brings his animal sacrifice. There may or may not be animal sacrifices in a future temple, but even if so, there will be a minor thing. Because I can't see a normal visitor, pilgrim nowadays, coming with an animal which is his friend. If he buys something on the entrance to the temple, may as well just pass his credit card for whatever pushka of good deeds. But it's a question of how people can bring something of the best in them, which still is not the final thing. You know, a person should bring himself or his own image through whatever types of works that represent as good as he can be, but then offer it as an offering. Be ready that something will happen in the temple, in through the company of other people engaged with this, all aiming at the highest purpose, that he may get some guidance how to redesign himself, or how to refashion himself now with the intention towards God, coming from all directions of the earth, becoming a part of his new self. So it's a design for a third temple which has many, many innovative aspects and much, much to think about. But another important thing that I want to emphasize is that I see the work beginning now through the virtual medium, through building a virtual temple, most likely through a series of lavish computer games, massively multi-user things. Because this is one way that's already exist in which millions of people can be engaged in some common quest. And then, of course, we can build whatever image of the temple as we want, and it's no reason for outcry, and it's no reason for starting wars, and so. All the same, my preference is to use a design that shows how the temple also physically can come up in Jerusalem, and not to disturb anything. So now I'm coming back to the issue of those four pictures. One of the guiding ideas there, that we paint all sorts of things, but keeping one thing clearly, nothing is changed over the Temple Mount. The same Dome of the Rock, the same Al-Aqsa stands there, not a stone moved, and all the same, the temple, the third temple, is in operation. In fact, much of seeing the Dome of the Rock is the Evena Pina, as a stone that the builders rejected became the cornerstone, because also over the years I have been studying the Dome of the Rock, and it's by far one of the most fabulous and most mysterious structures in the world. Everybody sees it and nobody understands what it is. People call it the Mosque of Omar. It has nothing to do with Omar. Came centuries later. There is a Mosque of Omar in the old city near the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's not, not only it's not the Mosque of Omar, it's not a mosque at all. It has none of the characteristics of a mosque. It's not meant for a prayer together and kneeling. It's not oriented towards Mecca. It's oriented towards itself, towards the rock there. It's definitely not a mosque. Why was it built? It's fascinating speculations. Open the book of Rabbi, what was his name? Shlomo Goren, Har HaBayit.
Of who now?
The former chief rabbi Shlomo Goren and chief rabbi of the army, who claims that the Dome of the Rock was built as a gift of the Muslims for the Jews, you know, was built as a synagogue for the Jews. We do know that the Templars, for instance, the Christian Crusaders, who occupied the Temple Mount, they preferred not to destroy this building, which looked as an affront to their Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But on the other hand, they called it Templo Domini. The own name Templars came from that. They built churches in Europe all over, much of the same circular form. And they held very secret rites, which probably were the reasons that eventually they were considered heretics and burnt at the stake by the church, by the Inquisition. But anyway, they held there some rites, which certainly were not oriented towards Mecca. And the place is there, and a very shrewd commentator in the most beautiful book about the Dome of the Rock, Oleg Graber, who wrote the definitive book about the Dome of the Rock, along with Palestinian photographer Said Nusaybe, he writes that intentionally the design of the Dome of the Rock is such, by its pure geometric design, that it allows any interpretation and any forms, and he said that it had housed various forms of liturgy, and he adds that it most likely will serve other future forms of liturgy. There is no need to touch, you know, a single part or a single stone of this fabulous building. To my mind, it's the ideal place for our ultimate reconciliation. We tried at one time to get to peace with the Palestinians and to give it the authority. The agreement was signed at the White House lawn, and it failed. The ultimate treaty, I suggest, should be signed on the rock, in the Dome of the Rock. Here is one thing that the local people, Am Haaretz, what I call, are most proud with. And it should, opening the doors there for some peace activity, is the noble, the right Muslim hospitality thing in my image, versus or in contradiction to this pushy Israeli way that Israel seems to want to occupy. That's a word that is often used. I think that a mutual recognition should be there. In fact, this old man in Jerusalem, André Chouraqui, who was once discussed as a potential president, He wrote a great book about the Old Testament, New Testament, and the Quran together with all kinds of searches and commentaries. He wrote a novel called A Letter to a Palestinian Brother, in which the ultimate reunion of these old friends who grew up in the old city happens under the Dome of the Rock. Incidentally, I think that the Templars were trying to affect the resurrection in this place. But it's an amazing space that it's amenable to the most sublime kind of a ritual or work, and it has not been in use for most of its life. It has been standing for 14 centuries up. Quite amazing for any building. I mean, it has been rebuilt several times, but true to the original. And yet, 90% of its time, it was without use. When it was inaugurated, the people who did the Avodat HaKodesh there were Jews. They brought especially, there were no Jews in Israel, in Jerusalem at the time, so they brought 70 families of Jews from Tiberias to do the work in there, to burn incense, ktoret, to spread rose water, to open the place to the public on Sheni v'Chamishi, on Mondays and Thursdays, the days we read the Torah. So for a short time, during the short-lived Umayyad dynasty, there were proper rituals in the Dome of the Rock. Then, from the time of the Abbas dynasty and on, nothing of any significance there, just to come and look at it. And then the Crusaders, as I mentioned, the Knights Templars, and then again, no significant use. The one use that it has these days is that on very busy Fridays, like the Fridays of the Ramadan, when they allowed to come tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, the women, they flock into it, you know, not to be surrounded by or touched by the men. And while there are also thousands of people bowing down to Mecca and turning the back to the Dome of the Rock as they are praying, the women are kept over there. And in fact, also nowadays it's not allowed for non-Muslims to visit, but I visited there enough to notice that it's generally women who are there. It's a very, very feminine structure. And instinctively, the women are there. You will see a circle of women with one teacher, a woman teacher, reading them the Quran. But why I mention this feminine character of it? Because sometimes when I meet New Agers coming here and saying, oh, we should have the Temple of the Goddess in Jerusalem, I tell him, it's already standing there. It has been standing for centuries, for over a millennium, but nobody noticed.
One question concerning that, Yitzchak, is how do you, or do you, conceive of, at this point in time, Jews and Arabs, Muslims and Jews, Israelis, Palestinians, being able to function together for a common goal, for the common good?
Well, my image, as I said very briefly, is that we Jews have gone through several very important stages in this restoration of Israel, but that has been prophesied and is the very reason and destiny and reason for our existence. But in the process, also getting traumatized, Holocaust and so, we saw Jewish survival as subsuming all of the story of restoration of Israel. Whereas in simple terms, Israel is more than Judea. Judea is a leading component of Israel, but it's not the whole story of Israel. And this we have forgotten totally. Moses had his great dream. You can see it in the last book of the Pentateuch, in Dvarim, chapter 1. He says, I wish there were 1,000-fold more than you are. He's talking to the 600,000 people and telling them, we want a nation 1,000 times larger. This is 600 million people. Israel of 600 million can make a difference in world culture and in the destiny of humankind. A state of Israel just maintaining its Jewish character and fighting against the whole Islamic world and being kind of illegitimate child of the Western world is not very likely to achieve that. It's when everything is only predicated to Jewish survival. And what I'm afraid, it also endangers Jewish survival. So I see, for instance, first of when I think about this larger Israel with its 12 tribes, not just one, yeah, I can see tribes of Christian Zionists who are becoming Israelites. I can see tribes of Muslim Zionists arising. And first and foremost, the amazing thing is that of the so-called Palestinian population of this country, a significant part of them are actually the Jews who stayed, who made the tzumud, the clinging to the land, when after the destruction of the temple, and especially in times of Hadrian in the second century, people were given the choice. You're either Jews or residents of this country, because Jews were no longer allowed, and many of them chose to cling to the land and stay. Then centuries later, there was this crazy Muslim Khalif called Al-Hakim, who considered that he was God incarnate in Islam, and he forbade Judaism and Christianity. So again, they forced people to become Muslims. So the people who stayed on the land at one time became Christian. Later, most of them became Muslims. But what contemporary research in genetics shows is that the Jew who now comes from Siberia or South America and descends in Ben Gurion Airport, he has this unique Jewish genes that you only find with Palestinians from Gaza or from Nablus and nowhere else in the world. So in fact, we are the remnants of one people. And if they can't be called Jews, and I have no quarrel to speak, to say that only rabbinical Judaism is Judaism. Okay, so maybe Reform Judaism is Volunism, and because we have 12 tribes, and one of them surely is a rabbinical Judaic tribe, and it's in a core, and it's like in a computer, you have the ROM, read-only memory. You don't expect it to change every time you open your computer. It better stay true to the code that it was coded. But it has other components, so you can do everything with your computer. And Israel can do much more than just Judah or Judaism can do for itself and for the world. Yet, being the platform where Judah and Jewish, and so is respected, is the senior, is gets all the respect and the honors, but yet it's not exclusive. So there is a place in my mind in Israel, in a new Israel, for the Palestinians. Even once people declare themselves as such Zionists, in fact, be they Muslims or Christians or any other, or Shinto, then by dint of this, they acknowledge the right of Jews, Israelis, to be here, to be even leaders, which is right now no Arab is ready to acknowledge the legitimacy of this. So by offering this identity, this Israelite identity to the Palestinians and to others who choose to, because what does it mean, Ama Bchira? It's not the chosen people, it's a choosing people. Because Jews are the people who chose to be Jews. If everybody who was born of the seed of Abraham or even of Jacob would have stayed, there would be as many Jews or Israelites as are Chinese. But the reason that there isn't, because not everyone chose to stay with this story, with this dream, with this family mythology, if you like. But significant number of people did. So we are now over 10 million people who do subscribe to it. But there are hundreds of millions of other people in the world who look at this story of Israel as a more significant story. And if the option was well formulated and articulated, because there are now movements. There are movements like Noah Heights, who keep the seven laws of Noah. There are, as I say, Christian Zionists. There is in the States something called Messianic Israel. Because, in fact, in every state of the Union now, in the United States, there are little sects and groups who feel themselves as Israelite identity with no connection to the state of Israel. They just think that the United States should have been Israel, which incidentally is very much, was very much the intention of some of the founding fathers of the United States. Another kind of forgotten history. So I see this larger framework which gives respects for this Jewish, Israeli, biblical story as its basis, and I think that on this basis there can be a place of honor for all those different tribes and a way to integrate together. And the temple, one thing, seems to me as the tool, the facility, for helping this new Israel to form and to establish itself.
There are two other words I wanted to ask you about that we've talked about over the years. One is Hebrew, and the other is Segula.
Hebrew can be, Ivrit can be translated as transcendental language. It's very much, definitely, I mentioned earlier about pattern language for design, for instance. But when you do a deep analysis of Hebrew, go into the letters, so you find that there are patterns. For instance, this facility in Hebrew to invent new words, you take a certain root of two or three letters, and twist it in a certain way, permutate it in a certain way, make a new word, but then everybody can understand what you mean already, because the root of the three letters carry a certain meaning. It's like a family of words. It's quite interesting that Hebrew actually has a very small vocabulary, of just a few thousands, a few tens of thousands words. It's not anything like so many words as in English, say, where you can make a dictionary with a million terms. But the language is much more plastic and can be played with in beautiful ways. Other thing is that I think we have lost the right diction in Hebrew. Somebody once explained to me that the Ashkenazi accent grew after the times of the great pogroms of the Crusades, where when the people who lived in those places by the Rhine country, the Jewish communities got so devastated that people eventually forgot how to speak the language. and then they reconstructed it according to the diction of the other languages around there. Anyway, for me, much of the liturgy is not right, because the diction, for instance, I go to synagogues where people very much like Shlomo Carlebach. And I've known Carlebach, I loved him. As I mentioned, I studied in Berkeley in the 60s, so I would go to his house of love and prayer near Haight Ashbury in San Francisco. And of course, it was very heart-touching experience to be in such, and all the singing was so beautiful. And yet, when I hear the people singing in our Lieder Minyan or other places like this, with this Ashkenazi diction, or even worse, singing beautiful tunes which do not touch the text at all, or use the text in the most arbitrary way for the fine tune, I say we haven't arrived there yet. Shlomo was trying to do something good, but this is Yiddishkeit. Now, in Israel, we should find the true way to sing the psalms, to pray our prayers with what's called Sephardi diction, which to my mind is more accurate, because maybe because I've been raised like that. And here is one thing that we have to learn, we may learn from the Arabs, because they live in a very odial culture, where the diction, when the way of speaking and so is very important. And when you think, how can we come together? How can we be a nation? How can one side not be feel inferior? So what does he have to contribute to this? To my mind, the people who stayed in the country, they may have left the proper formal religion, rabbinical Judaism, but they kept the diction. They kept the tone of the language, which is more appropriate for this climate, for this place, for these subtle influences of the land. And there is much to learn from them.
How about the word segula?
Well, most people take segula to mean uniqueness, being different than any other. For me, it has something to do, as we talked earlier in Hebrew, about the roots, that when you start playing with the roots, permutate, a meaning comes. We use this root of sa, samech gimel lamed, Segel, Sagol, also for histagel, in this reflective mood, to get adjusted. And to my mind, part of the segula of Am Yisrael was its ability to lehistagel, to adjust himself. There is a beautiful book by a Finnish author called Diamant, called something like The Indestructible Jews, or when he defines that the reason that the Jews managed to survive so well through so many different cultures and civilizations and come on top in almost each one of them was the great ability to get adjusted, to adjust to those cultures. So this is histaglut. So I think that part of the segula, of the uniqueness of the Jews, is this flexibility and inventiveness and ability to adjust to different cultures and to complement them and to know how to use and bring the best in them.
Thank you, Yitzchak. I think we should pause for a minute. My arm is going to fall off.